So it's my pleasure this morning to introduce our guest speaker. Michael Esselin, BCC, serves as the oncology chaplain for the Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. He speaks extensively to doctors, nurses, social workers, patient populations, and faith communities across the country about his work. Michael weaves stories with insight, vulnerability, and humor to wrap around the larger questions of life, mortality, and meaning. He has also been an active educator and activist, addressing anti-LGBT bias for well over 25 years. He has a TED Talk and has been published widely in journals and periodicals. He will have 3 volumes of CDs available for purchase after the service, each including 3 of his talks, and volume 3 is brand new. And I want to say a special word of gratitude for Michael. Michael, we love you. Late or on time, we are so, you can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned. We are so happy to have you here. So let's give Michael some love as we welcome him to the stage.
I deeply apologize for any worry, fretting, consternation I caused everyone. It's one of those days when everything that could have gone wrong went wrong this morning. But I'm here, and in remembering who I am, I'm also remembering that I'm a mess, too. Yeah. My mom is fond of saying that we don't change much. In her view, who we were as kids, even as little toddlers, is who we still are today, as heaven help me, senior citizens. It's a little deflating, I must admit, when I walk through my entire life's journey thinking it is about growing and changing, self-actualization, particularly when the very core of a spiritual belief that's kept me afloat nearly my entire adult life would say that it is indeed about growing into a deeper understanding and experience of our oneness, mutuality, kinship, to use Father Greg Boyle's word. And that the pathway to that mutuality is one of intimacy and connection, and an old-fashioned religious word, communion, stepping out, reaching toward the other. But we don't live in an either-or world, do we? We live in a both-and world. So I suppose there's room for both ideas to be true. In describing each of her 3 kids, my mom would characterize me, among other things, as the explorer. I was a little surprised by that when she shared it with me a few years ago, because it's not a label with which I ever would have identified. But she reminds me that my idea of fun at age 10 or so on a Sunday afternoon would be to buy an unlimited all-day bus pass on the Long Beach Municipal bus lines and just get on the bus and ride to wherever, exotic destinations like Artesia or Paramount. I do love to travel, there's no doubt about that. I would spend my last nickel on a trip to some exotic destination, and very nearly have. Still, I'm struck by this paradox between the idea that there's somewhere to go and something to get and something to become, and yet we don't change. Caught in our own caste system, perhaps, by design. Instead of buying into this assumption that it is all about growing and changing, aiming towards some vague fantasy of perfection, maybe it's really just about becoming more of who we are, falling in love with that. Even Dorothy Gale offered that wisdom nearly 80 years ago in The Wizard of Oz. If I ever go looking for my heart's desire again, I'll never look further than my own backyard, because if it isn't there, I never really lost it to begin with. So what do we make then of this whole concept of pilgrimage? It's a word that has religious and spiritual connotations, to be sure, but we make pilgrimages for all kinds of reasons. Maybe to prove something to ourselves or to others. I have a patient, Raphael, in his 20s, who has a pretty aggressive sarcoma, and he recently climbed to the top of Mount Whitney, in part just to prove to himself that he could, that the cancer hadn't completely defeated him yet. And it was also a way, as he saw, to honor all those he'd met along the way who had never been able to make such a climb. He'd carry them in his heart while he hiked. Well, that is most definitely a pilgrimage. We might make a pilgrimage to find something, spiritual inspiration or awakening. We might make a pilgrimage to return to something, a childhood home, an ancestral burial ground. For me, pilgrimage is ultimately about connecting to something. Something within, something without, internal and external pilgrimages. Of course, a pilgrimage needn't necessarily even be intentional. Life has a way of sending us on a journey without so much as asking our permission. Cancer would be such a journey. A pilgrimage towards spiritual essence, if you will, of discovery of who I am if I'm not all those things I did, all those things I thought I was, all those things I accomplished. Richard had been a brilliant, highly regarded engineering professor. He now has a brain tumor. Michael, I used to be smart. That's who I was. But I'm not smart anymore. I can't find the easiest word to finish a simple sentence. And I've never really been what you call a people person. I've never really had friends to speak of, and that's been okay with me till something like this happens. The sad irony is that through his shared loss and vulnerability, I found Richard utterly likable. I suppose in a classical sense, for any pilgrimage to reveal the full depth and breadth of its meaning, a certain amount of effort is required, diligence, maybe even suffering. Think of walking the Camino de Santiago across northern Spain, or for a Muslim to make Hajj, pilgrimage to Mecca, or simply climbing to the top of a mountain. As anyone can attest who's ever climbed the 4-mile trail up from the Yosemite Valley floor up to Glacier Point, the reward of that view can be most exhilarating and gratifying. But I would ask, does that very same view mean the same thing to the tourist who just stepped off the air-conditioned bus in the Glacier Point parking lot as it does to the one who so painstakingly climbed up from the valley floor step by step by step? As with so many pursuits in life, I imagine our pursuit of spiritual awakening and inspiration can be tripped up by our assumptions and expectations. For instance, oh, Michael, if you ever get to see the sunrise at Machu Picchu, it's absolutely transformational. Or if you ever get to meditate inside the Great Pyramid, it's absolutely life-changing. Well, for the 10-year-old boy for whom a bus ride to Artesia was an adventure, such promises leave my tongue wagging. But for the part of me that's wary of promises implicit in the whole idea of reaching one's goals, I have to return to my own hard-won wisdom that if I knew what I was going to learn before I took this class, I never would have had to take the class. I have been fortunate to have made some of those fabled pilgrimages of the external variety, and I dream of making more. I did finally get to see the sunrise at Machu Picchu, and I did get to meditate inside the Great Pyramid. I've prayed at the Western Wall, and I've stood among the faithful on the banks of the Ganges. And in each instance, the sheer anticipation of spiritual awakening, maybe even a touch of the mystical, was almost unbearable. And in each instance, I met with disappointment. Even stepping away from the moment, feeling a little disjointed. Hey, I was supposed to feel this. Where's my electric buzz from the touch of the magic sword? Know the gift and the magic in each journey, and it was always there in spades, don't get me wrong. But it always came tiptoeing in through the side door, while my focus and expectation were elsewhere. In September of 2011, I took a trip by myself to Peru to join a small hiking group hiking through the Sacred Valley, making our way to Machu Picchu. High in the Andes, we came upon this small village where we were scheduled to visit a school. Our guide, Peter, had even brought a couple soccer balls to give to the kids. But when we got to the school, we found it absolutely deserted, not a soul around. And it's mid-morning on a school day. So Peter pokes around the village and is told that one of the matriarchs of the village had died. She happened to be the mother of Enrique, who was one of the porters who worked for the same tour company as ours. The whole village had stopped, kids and everybody, just to go to the funeral. Peter said, "So let's go." I was feeling equally excited and fascinated and uncomfortable as hell to intrude on such a personal and sacred event. We walked up this long, dusty dirt road up to the burial ground that was a small plot of earth framed by a low stone wall. The entire population of the village was contained within that wall. Peter walked up to Enrique to offer his condolences, and Enrique immediately walked over to the three of us standing outside the wall, our hiking poles in hand, our backpacks, our big hats to shield us from the Andean sun. And he invited us inside the wall. That's it right there. Just being invited inside the wall. He even introduced me to his beautiful little boy who had just lost his grandmother. And in my pitiful Spanish, I asked the boy about his abuela, and he told me. And then Peter explained it was customary at these rituals to pass around a bottle of beer and for everyone to drink from the same bottle. But this being a Christian family, they were passing around a rancid bottle of soda and a dirty, rusty tin cup. And then the cup was offered to me. Uh-oh. I've got days of hiking ahead of me, Machu Picchu. I've been saving for months for this trip. It could all be ruined with this one sip. But how can I say no once I've been invited inside the wall? And so I drank, and I was fine, more than fine. They never explained communion quite like that when I was taking catechism. A number of years earlier, October 07, my husband Scott and I took a trip to Egypt. And after spending many days on the Upper Nile, seeing all the amazing sights there, we had a couple days in Cairo and had a day scheduled to go out to Giza to see the pyramids and the Sphinx. And that day it happened to be crushingly hot. Our guide, Hani Hamsa, offered us the option of going inside the Great Pyramid and climbing into the king's burial chamber, but he warned us that one has to crouch in a near-crawling position in a very tight, steep tunnel to get to the chamber, that it can be very hot, crowded, claustrophobic. Scott opted out, choosing to wait in the air-conditioned car, and I said, there's no way I'm missing this, so I bought a ticket and went inside. Hani did not exaggerate. I assumed the posture for the long ascent, and I'm hitting my head on the roof of the tunnel every third step, cursing a blue streak. And I finally reached the chamber, and oh my God, what a relief just to stand erect after all of that. And then to truly try to grasp where I am in this moment. Hey, I made a cross-section model of this very pyramid in seventh grade social studies. Plywood, flour and water paste. It was brilliant. I got an A. And here I am. And of course, there are other tourists there behaving, in my view, inappropriately. Laughing, talking, carrying on, jumping into the empty stone sarcophagus in the middle of the chamber, posing for a selfie. I'm getting righteously annoyed and feeling very spiritually superior. I'm praying the crowd might thin out a bit so I can sit down and try to meditate. So happily, the crowd does disperse a little bit. I go in the corner and I sit down and I get myself all situated and close my eyes, take a few nice deep breaths, and I think, you know, I think I have to go to the bathroom. No, I really have to go to the bathroom. Oh, Christ, I got up. Excuse me. I make my way to the entrance of the tunnel, and I assume the posture for the long descent down. And what better posture to try to hold it, mind you? I had this Japanese woman's ass in my face, and I was just praying she could move those little pink tennis shoes a little more quickly. And I'm hanging on, and I think, oh no, that's it. I'm going to crap my pants right here in the Great Pyramid. No, Michael, you can do it. And then I see it, the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel. And I make my way to the opening and I ask the attendant, where's the toilet? And she points hundreds of yards across the hot desert sand. I take off running like I have never run before. Scott told me later that Hani had looked up from the car and said, look, there goes Michael, running. In such a hurry, he's so fast. And I make it to the trailer, and of course, there's an attendant there who needs money to use the toilet and for a few pitiful pieces of toilet paper. And I just happened to have the right Egyptian coin in my pocket, and I made it without a nanosecond to spare. I have never felt gratitude quite like that. It was my own little Egyptian miracle. Talk about a sacred pilgrimage. Well, a few years ago when I was here, invited to speak, I got here on time then, in time to have enough of a conversation with Reverend Bonnie before the service, talking about all sorts of things. We were talking about church ministry versus hospital chaplaincy. Somehow we got on the subject of embarrassing moments, and I told her that story. And then we needed to focus on the service and who was going to do what, but not without Bonnie first commenting, "Michael, I so enjoyed our conversation, particularly the mixture of the earthly and the sacred." And my question then, as it is now, is which is which? I've told that story many times, as you might imagine, since we went to Egypt, always gets a big laugh of recognition. We've all been there, you know. Annie Lamott calls laughter carbonated holiness. Is it possible that there's something more sacred in that shared laughter than there could ever be in any wisdom that's going to come to a guy like me meditating inside the Great Pyramid? Is it possible that there's a deeper sense of communion in that? Of all the destinations we've traveled, none has elicited more polarized and predictable responses from others than India. In planning the trip, there were those whom I would tell I was going who would swoon with envy and could share with me my excitement. And then there were those who would comment, and not without a little judgment in their voice, "Why would you ever want to go there? That's one place I have no desire to see. Here it's absolutely filthy, and the poverty is overwhelming." One comment that took me aback, I must say, but still reverberates somewhat, "Michael, haven't you had enough life-changing experiences?" I guess not. One day, we had an impossibly long drive from Jaipur to Agra. Nearing lunchtime, our driver, Sonu, a lovely Sikh gentleman with limitless patience and calm, turned left off the main highway onto this choked side road that soon enough became dirt and then mud, leading into this small village where there was so much commotion, activity, noise going on. Horns honking from motorcycles and tuk-tuks, cows in the street, garbage everywhere, people scrambling about, architecture that looked to be one step above a lean-to. And then we turned right into this nondescript driveway and were jettisoned into another universe altogether. Something evoking the serenity of a French country estate. We get out of the car and we walk down this long flagstone path framed by two rows of leafy green shade trees. At the end of the path is this lovely, formally designed Indian building in delicious decay, pink. We turn left, walk down another long flagstone path framed by another arcade of trees, and at the end of that path is another much smaller pink building that's the restaurant where we're going to be having our lunch. Turns out this is a hotel for birders. The whole compound is a sanctuary for migrating fowl. All this serenity is steps away from the kind of squalor one is used to seeing any given evening on the NBC Evening News behind Richard Engel, reporting from some war-torn country or another. And I felt this familiar but uncomfortable awareness that I'm not only an observer of these stark contrasts, I am most definitely a participant. So do I quiet my conscience by reminding myself at least I'm here pumping a few dollars into the economy, at least I'm here bearing some witness? I've spent some time wondering why it is that I love this kind of travel so much. Why would I spend so much money to travel down that mud road? The first stop on our itinerary was Mumbai. We landed there and spent a few days. And one afternoon, our guide, Parvez, took us on a driving tour through the city, and she drove us through what she described was the wealthiest neighborhood of Mumbai, Malabar Hill. She was quoting astronomical prices for these condos and flats in these sleek towers that were nevertheless sheathed in the grimy film of intractable pollution. But at street level, it looked like any other street in Mumbai. There was still garbage and decay, decrepit little shops. It wasn't like it suddenly became Newport Beach or Beverly Hills, all manicured perfection. It was all messy as hell. There's simply no escaping the caste system made manifest. In each subsequent city that we visited, our guide would always ask, where else in India had we been? And when we would answer that we started in Mumbai, without exception, they would swoon, "Oh, Mumbai, such a beautiful city, isn't it?" Yes, it is. But it's a whole other kind of beauty. It's a beauty that's inclusive of the mess. It's not Paris. I remember in the late 60s, early 70s, one of my favorite attractions at Disneyland was the General Electric Carousel of Progress in Tomorrowland. I remember at the end of the presentation, you went up a long conveyor ramp that led to this platform where they reveal this dazzling animated model of the city of the future, where they were quick to point out the tunnels under the city for trucks, services, garbage collection, so no one would have to look at the mess. And I realized that's it right there. Part of why I love this kind of travel so much. It's the same exhilaration I feel in my work. Being immersed in the messiness of life as it is. Uncontrollable, unpredictable, filled with the inevitability of loss. Every month, I facilitate a spiritual reflection group at the Sims Mann Center where I work. And not long ago, the conversation had turned to the phenomenon that some patients face when they simply hit a wall with respect to their treatment. Some, ravaged by chemo and radiation, find themselves saying, "That's it, no more. I'm cooked. Time to let the disease take its course." And then their oncologist might say, "But wait, there's this new drug trial coming down the pike. Okay, I'm in." By way of an explanation, Loween, who always brings a quiet, gentle wisdom to the conversation, suggests that no matter how defeated we might feel by life, she believes life calls to us. I love that, the simplicity of that, the profundity of that. Life calls to us. Life certainly called to every one of those villagers scrambling in the mud that afternoon. Life called to every one of the 8 or 10 men perilously huddled and perched on the rear bumper of a van barreling down the highway, clinging to the luggage rack as they clung to life. There is life force in the mess. And yet we in this culture have almost made a religion of denying the mess, deluding ourselves that life can or should be mess-free. Consider as an illustration the whole intention and design of a community like Irvine. No mess. When we got home, there were those who would call and say, "So how was it?" And some would ask in a way that revealed far more of their own preconceptions and assumptions than any genuine curiosity about mine. "Well, I hear it's quite an assault on the senses and that the poverty's overwhelming. I'm sure it left you feeling so much gratitude for all the blessings we have here, right?" Such sentiments couldn't be farther off the mark for me. That would be my essential takeaway message, gratitude for my blessings? To me, that would seem arrogant. To think that because of some stroke of dumb luck or some benevolent force in the universe, I was born into this reality with these advantages and privileges, and those poor folks were not. Gee, I must be God's favorite. Too bad for them. Of course, I am profoundly, deeply grateful for my advantages and privileges, but I was grateful before I went to India. No, I think I invest in this kind of travel to be put into the state of unease with the messiness of life as it is. And I believe there's an element of sacred pilgrimage in that. I have a patient, Alice, in her 60s, who for years has been living with a very rare lymphoma, but more recently has been plagued by this necrotic wound on her leg that simply won't heal, goes right down to the exposed bone, causing her intractable pain. I was with her and her husband in the exam room when the nurse came in to clean out the wound and repack it and bandage it in a vain attempt to save her leg. While she screamed in agony, I just sat there holding her hand. And I realized in that moment I have a choice to make. Am I going to look down and look at the wound and bear witness to the reality of what she's living with? Or am I going to choose to look away? When we got back, my mom called and said, "How could you stay at such nice hotels when there's so much poverty right outside the door in India?" It's a fair statement and question, but Mom, there's poverty just as fierce on so many streets in Los Angeles today The thing is, we have the space and the room and the opportunity to look away. It can be blinding to contrast the reality of life in India or on so many streets in Los Angeles with the American values we've all been force-fed, that you can be, do, and have anything you want if you're willing to work for it. Such values are also infused into so many of the religious traditions in which we've been raised. Ask and it shall be given to you. With God, all things are possible. Or in a New Age sense, I only have to envision it and affirm it and claim it, and it will be mine. Back home and back to my routine for a few days, I was driving home from work listening to a podcast, a discussion between Krista Tippett and Paulo Coelho, the Brazilian author of the bestseller, The Alchemist, in which he puts forth his theory that we're here on earth to discover and live out our own personal legend. And as I listened, I thought of those 8 or 10 men barreling down some dusty highway in Rajasthan. And suddenly, his idea seemed hopelessly naive, maybe even a little ridiculous. And yet a part of me believes it. After all, I'm an American who desires and longs for more. I think most of us want more. We want to see more. We want to love more. We want to learn more. We want to have more. And yet it may also be true in the deepest possible way that there is nowhere to go, nothing to get, and nothing to become. T.S. Eliot reminds us the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. And I think, yep, that's true. But don't I need to do the exploring first? Maybe in the end, my mom was right that we don't change so much from when and where we started. Oh, maybe in a few cosmetic ways, lighting, costumes, scenery, and a plot twist or two, but maybe in the most essential way, not. Might there be a kind of comfort to be found in that? A kind of peace to be found in the idea that everything is not possible, that life and people have limitations, that perhaps we are caught in a caste system of sorts? I remember 20, 30 years ago undergoing some intense psychotherapy and bemoaning to the therapist that I always seemed to be returning to the same 5 or 6 issues and themes over and over again, never getting anywhere. All she said was, "Aren't you glad there's only 5 or 6? I hold this image of myself as a 7-year-old boy. The age of reason, according to the Catholic tradition in which I was raised, the age at which we can supposedly discern the dualities of life, right from wrong, good from evil, the age at which we participate in the sacrament of Holy Communion. And I find myself wondering in the deepest possible way if I'm still on that long pilgrimage to the altar, opening myself, preparing myself to be ready at any given moment to step up and step out and receive Holy Communion with life. So be it. Thank you.